This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Ng Teck. Last week, Dato' Sri Najib Razak was charged on 3 counts of criminal breach of trust and 1 count of using his position for gratification. I have Farid Azad in the studio with me to talk about this issue of lawyers having to defend maybe unpopular figures, figures who are considered unsavory or disliked by the public. Farid, thank you for coming again.
My pleasure.
So, I guess everyone is talking about the gag order that was granted on an interim basis by the judge. Mm. Are we possibly in contempt of court now by just referring or talking about or alluding to this case?
No, I don't think so. You haven't asked me anything about the case, so I think we're good so far.
So the judge, media reports have stated, is related to an UMNO politician. Mm. Who is currently within the Pahang state government. Is this a conflict of interest or is it just bad optics?
I would say, let me answer it this way. I don't think there is straightforward conflict of interest, okay? It's not patently obvious. But I think we have to look at justice requires 2 things. That justice be done and justice be seen to be done. And given the person who is being prosecuted this time, that it is different lah. It is not your every typical day kind of criminal case. This involves the former prime minister of our country. He also was the president of UMNO. So I think taking a wider look at that context, even though I don't think there's a conflict of interest where the judge is concerned, I think in terms of perception, it is not, it doesn't give a good impression of how proceedings may go.
Yeah.
Because you don't want the public lingering at the back of their mind that, oh, he made this decision because his brother is in UMNO. You know, so he may be a great judge. He may get everything right. But if it doesn't look right, it's still not good.
As you mentioned, this is our former leader and the former president of UMNO. And so many people are saying this is unprecedented. Mm. Unprecedented, I think, is the second most used word last week other than the gag order.
Right.
But is it not comparable to what Anwar went through in 98 and in 2010 and then subsequently after that?
Well, Anwar was only a deputy prime minister at the time. And circumstances in which he was charged were quite different.
Different how?
Different in a sense that, well, the perception was that, okay, it was a political persecution, right? In this case, it is about corruption that happened under his reign, for example. And this prosecution is taking place under a new government, which is, again, unprecedented. And I think with a very different type of attorney general. Mm. So I think Just from that, there are many, many different things. We can get into the details of just how different it is. So for me, the way I see it, I don't think this is a case of political persecution, although I know that's how they're playing it. So that's the difference, I think.
As a ex-leader or former prime minister, will he enjoy any privileges in the court of law or when?
Of course not. Well, there's Article 8.1. You know, we're all equal before the law. And no, there are no special privileges for him. Although I will note that it appears that there is some. For example, he was allowed to pay bail in installments. Well, in all my practice, I think that's unheard of.
Right. No matter the quantum, if it's like...
Yeah, no matter the quantum, man. You don't pay, you just stay.
So another unprecedented instance in the case. What can we expect? Because Najib will be the second ex-leader to be prosecuted in Southeast Asia and the fifth in Asia. What can we expect? Could we even glean any lessons from what these former presidents and prime ministers in the region has went through?
I think what we can draw from that is that perhaps, one, people are not going to take things just lying down these days. They're a bit more enlightened about their rights, about what they can do about abuses or you know, acts of corruption that they find, right? And that now that they can actually, one, change that power structure and leave them vulnerable to prosecution. Because otherwise, you know, most of the time, all these very, very powerful leaders will have the entire administration under their control, and it's virtually impossible to prosecute them.
So we need good systems to withstand abuses by the people.
Yeah. I mean, aside from just a good system, we need good people, we need brave people to stand up and call a spade. If it's not right, it's not right.
Even in the face of a gag order.
Yeah.
Why do we even have a gag order? Or why do we even allow the option of a gag order? Because we don't have a trial by jury system. It's a trial by judge system.
Yeah, I'm puzzled myself why there's this gag order. I'm going to use the word unprecedented again. I mean, usually they don't. Mm. Because I noticed the basis of the order is for the media not to discuss it and purportedly so that he can have a fair trial. I don't see the relevance of that because the trial happens in court. It doesn't happen in the media. And people are free to think what they like, right? If they want to think him guilty, that's up to them. But for purposes of the law, the law has to assume him innocent until guilty. And for the law, there are these safeguards because he's going to be prosecuted. He's going to be found guilty. Maybe, right? And so there are serious consequences to it. So that's why different rules apply to those in court and those outside of court.
Right.
Yeah.
So lawyers who are actively representing the defendant or a plaintiff, they should not be talking to the media, but everyone not related in the case should
yeah.
be allowed to.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
So we have rules for the Attorney General not to speak to the media?
No, there are no real rules about that, you know. I think this is very much a question of practice. And this is just my personal view that really when you're doing a prosecution or you're doing a defense, you just don't want to say things out in the media, right? Because all these can then be pulled into court and you can be asked about it. Mm-hmm. So...
Can I get you to clarify on that?
Yeah.
You mean like what you say in a press conference can be used against you?
Yeah, for example, some of my criminal friends, we are looking at what's going on, for example, and like say in Najib's case, he's coming out to say certain things about 1MDB and stuff like that. From a criminal lawyer point of view, you don't want to be saying these things in public, right? Mm-hmm. Because these can be brought in to court. And you
right.
can be cross-examined about it. So you really want to say as little as possible out there. And I think the same would go for the prosecution as well. Because you're giving information about the case. You may be giving information about strategy, right?
Right.
So unless this is a public interest case where you are trying to change opinion, then yeah, okay, you can have you can have this almost walking commentary about your case. But in a criminal case... I don't know. I don't think for myself that would be a prudent thing to do.
People are also talking about the possibility of this trial being live streamed because of the nature of how interested everyone is.
Mm.
Is that possible? Are there any rules against video cameras or handphones going into the courtroom?
The courtroom actually is a public... It is open to public generally. Technically, it is open. So, yeah, it can have televised proceedings. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's also good for the system. Yeah, people can see how it works.
This too would be unprecedented.
Yeah, this too would be unprecedented.
Right.
Well, as I think I can safely say, we live in unprecedented times, right?
I'm speaking today to lawyer Fari Azad about defending unpopular people. Up next, we'll address some of the issues in legal ethics. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Trot and Tick. With me in the studio today, Fari Azad, lawyer, about the case that the government is building around Dato' Sri Najib Razak. Three counts of criminal breach of trust and one count of using his position for gratification. Najib would need lawyers to defend him. He has hired Tan Sri Shafi Abdullah, who gave a press conference on how they intend to defend Najib. Why do lawyers take on unpopular clients? In this instance, people could say, I mean, accusations has been that it's because of money. But in general, what goes through a lawyer's mind when they see something like this that ostensibly, you know, their client or potential client, it's guilty?
Okay, what goes through a lawyer's mind? We don't really think very much. We're thinking more about the case. You know, we're thinking about, okay, what can we do? You know, because you... In Malaysia, there is this, how should I say, there's this idea of the cab rank rule. Cab rank rule originates from England by the barristers. And the idea for this is very much this. Whoever comes to us, so long as we agreed on the fee and the work, then they can appoint us. And lawyers are not supposed to pick and choose their clients. Now, the idea of that is so that, look, everybody has... can appoint a lawyer, and lawyers can't just kick somebody off and say, look, I don't want to do your case because I don't like your face or something. You know, that's not a good reason, right? So even in our etiquette rules, we are supposedly bound to take work unless for some special reason or circumstance, we choose not to, right? So, and we don't really care whether the client is guilty or not. You know, that's not for us to decide. That really is the court's job. We're just there to give the best defense that we can come up with, given the evidence and given what our client tells us.
Sorry, Chua,
I just want to also say a bit more about this because it's a question that comes up a lot. I always get asked this, Fari, if you know your client's guilty, will you do the case? And I say, yeah, no problem, you know, because when a lawyer defends an accused person, he's actually, in truth, not wholly defending the accused person. He's also defending the system. He's defending the system of criminal justice. Now, if lawyers then started to say, I don't want to take this case because everybody thinks he's guilty, then what happens to rule of law? You know, what happens with the need to prove that this person committed this offense? So a lot of it, the misconception comes from people looking at things in the micro. They just see us defending this guy. They don't see the larger system we are trying to uphold. So we are there to make sure the evidence is good. Okay, if the evidence is beyond reasonable doubt and it's proper, then he gets convicted. That's it. Right.
But if you know that your client or the person is guilty, doesn't that affect your strategy, because you're not supposed to lie to the court too?
That's right. Absolutely. It definitely inhibits our strategy. Okay. So when an accused client tells us, Fari, I did it, right? I certainly cannot put him up on the stand there and say, did you do it? Right. So it would be more of a technical play, really. Right, you're going to look much closer at the technicalities. Is there a break in the chain of evidence? Right, was the evidence stored properly? Was this person properly authorized? So you're going to have to attack the more technical areas of the law.
So what legal guilt as opposed to factual guilt? Doesn't matter whether or not the person did it. What matters is whether the court or the opponent can prove that the person did what he did.
That's right.
If that's the case, then what is this system that you are trying to uphold and protect if it's not about seeking the truth?
Okay. It is about ensuring that a person who has been is charged, the evidence against him is proper and it's credible. Okay? Because we have to go back a bit. Before, the kings had all power. Okay? They could decide. So rule of law basically kind of broke that up. Okay? So you have law, you have the prosecutor, and you have the lawyer, right? And the idea is this. Every person accused has to be proved that he did that offense before an independent tribunal, and he had an opportunity to defend himself. That is the system. And we are an important part of that system, right? Because without lawyers, without that right to defend yourself, all it needs to do is say, Chua, it's you. You did it. Okay, now you go to jail, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't have to prove anything. So that's what that whole system is about. It's about having to prove that you did this beyond a reasonable doubt. And the reason for that is because the consequences are serious, right? Your liberty is curtailed. Your reputation is tarnished, right? So it needs to be a very high standard before you suffer those consequences.
This cap rank rule that you mentioned, is it a code of conduct or is it a rule that is enforced among lawyers?
Well, these are the kind of rules I think are observed more in breach than in compliance, lah. I hate to say that. Yeah. Yeah.
Are there not economic consequences for the lawyers to take on this negative coverage?
Not really, I think. I had a very good friend. He had to do a difficult criminal case. It was one of those, you know, everybody felt, oh, they did it. And, you know, what awful people they are. They shouldn't have lawyers. And he signed up. And he had trouble with his family because they didn't quite understand. And they said, why are you defending this guy? And he said, look, this is my job. You know, it's nothing personal. It's not like I like the guy, but it's something I have to do. So I think the challenge around here comes more from your family, your friends who kind of put pressure on you. It's not so much from the profession. From the profession, you know, you get a high-profile, difficult criminal case. Everybody's thinking, wow, well done, mate, you know. And I don't think it will affect his income in any way. In fact, I think it heightens their profile because now they've got this difficult case under their belt. Everybody knows about it. Whenever it happens again, they know the guy to call, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Because you have some personal experience with this as well, defending someone who has been accused of sexual harassment. Maybe you can walk us through some of your experience in that professionally as well as among family members and friends. Mm. What has been the reception that you got? Did you feel like you constantly have to, you know, say what you're saying to me?
Right. I think among my family and friends, no. I think they kind of know this is my job. They know what I stand for, right? But I get a lot of these questions at parties, at social functions, and, you know, when people get excited, they're like, oh, there's a lawyer at the table. Great. Now we'll ask him all our legal questions, right? So, okay, hit me. And one of the number one ones are always, Farif, you know they did it, you know, how can you defend them? You know, so I even wrote an article on that because I just answered it so many times and I just wanted to point people to that article, right? Yeah. So it really depends how you want to do your case. So let's come back to that point, like where they say, what if you know your client did it? You know, am I the kind of lawyer that wants to know whether my client did it? I would ask them, look, I want everything. I want to know. Right. I know there are some who approach it differently by saying something like, so what's your story? Right. So, you know, that's sometimes you don't want to know. You don't want to know because, as I say, it hampers you. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So sometimes they take a different route and say, you know, not what happened, but so what was the story there?
Yeah.
Right.
So why do you want to know then? Because if you don't know, then you have none of this moral dilemma. You
can
execute the best possible defense.
Yeah, but you know, for me, in the experience in the criminal cases I did, look, the lies don't hold up under intense scrutiny. You will be found out. Okay. And there's this case that I always tell all my lawyers to say, this is why sometimes it's difficult. I had a drug client case. It was one of those, he was caught at the airport, right? And he said, oh, I have this guy's phone number. And he said, it is definitely in my phone. It's definitely in my phone. And we went the whole way. I didn't trust him, but I kept asking him, is it in the phone? Are you sure it's in the phone? And we got to the point in the defense, you know, that was the crucial moment. He had to show that phone number. Okay. And we had come to this point 2-3 months in, full trial. And every time he tells me, yes, the phone number's in there. The phone number's in there. When we get to that golden moment, he turns on the phone, the number's not in there. Gone. Mm-hmm. You know, that's your whole defense. Finish. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing you can do about it. So that's why I don't like that. I don't like the surprise at the end of it. I was so angry with him. Okay, sorry, you're asking about sexual harassment, but yeah. That wasn't actually a criminal case. That was a civil case that I did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
Maybe you can talk about the difference.
Well, the big difference is really in terms of proof where civil and criminal are concerned. Civil cases, you prove things on a balance of probability, right? And usually, both sides will give evidence. Whereas in criminal... as much as possible as a criminal lawyer, we do not want the defense to be called, right? Because defense means our client has to be on the stand. He's got to tell his story. The prosecutor is going to have cross-examine him. And all we can do is cross our fingers and hold our breath to see what comes out.
There is this case that I came across through a podcast. It's called the buried bodies case. And it's a variation of the question that you often get asked at parties. You mentioned if you know your client did it, would you still defend it? So this one goes like this. If a murder suspect tells his attorneys that where the bodies are, the bodies that of people he has killed, where he buried them, are his lawyers obligated to report that information to the court or the police? So what are the limits of confidentiality?
Well, if that is part of what he tells us, say, for example, while we're taking his defense, we're preparing his defense, then no. But if he has called me and says, Fari, I'm going to kill some people in about half an hour, I'm going to be in this place, then yeah, you know, we cannot use confidentiality to facilitate an illegality, right? So for that, we are not bound.
Right.
Yeah. But anything else that doesn't measure up to that, then no, we can't.
Yeah. Because I think the human, or rather the heartrending part about this was that the lawyer defending this murderer accused at the time, he was assigned to him, and that the parents of the girls who were missing came to him and asked him personally, do you know anything about this? Because there has been suspicion that the person that he was defending was linked to these murders. And also the fact that the lawyer's own daughters were friends with the girls who were missing then.
Right.
And so the lawyer in question here chose not to reveal that information. And so you would concur with that decision?
Yeah, I would. That's our professional duty. That's our ethics. And... I think as much as we feel for them, as much as we sympathize, we can't.
So for Najib, because he can afford his own lawyers, he can get the best. But for those who do not have the means or the resources to do so, in Malaysia, would the court assign that person a lawyer?
Yeah. In Malaysia, if you are faced with a death penalty offense and you cannot afford a lawyer, one will be assigned to you. And... I will say the quality for that varies. I mean, you had some really great people doing those kind of cases. But yeah, so it's very random. For those who are not facing a death penalty offense, I think you can get representation from the National Legal Aid Foundation. And
for the assignment, is it from a database of lawyers who have volunteered to do pro bono cases?
That's right. So, assigned counsel for death penalty offenses, those are assigned by the court and paid by the court, right? So, it's a different roster. And they have certain criteria. They want a bit of experience before you can do death penalty cases, but they don't require training. Whereas for the National Legal Aid Fund, those you have to go for training. So there's a 2 or 3 part training. You go for it. Once you go through that, then you're allowed to take cases.
I guess to conclude, what would your message be? I mean, what would you want to say that you can refer all those questions that you will get in future dinner parties? That, hey, you got, just listen to that podcast and why lawyers defend seemingly bad people.
It's an article I wrote many years ago on Lawyer Bureau. That's right. And I think it's something like, why you defend those criminals are something like that. Yeah.
And the main point is you have to defend the system.
That's right. If you understand the larger context in which we work in, it's about defending the system, not so much the accused, although that's what it looks like.
Thank you. I guess we'll look forward to developments with bated breath. Next year, right? The earliest that this...
Oh, this is going to go on for a long time, so...
I guess we'll get you on back then when it gets too complicated to kind of and untangle these complications. Fari, thank you again for taking the time.
My pleasure.
So if you miss any part of this interview, you can download the podcast via our BFM app on the App Store or Google Play. Thank you for listening. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.